Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
So there's a misconception that if you're single, you are incomplete, perhaps damaged, salvaged, and you won't be happy until you find your one. And that is not true. That is bullshit. It is a message that has been fed to us by media and advertising. The truth is, when you're single, you have the richest soil for growth. That's why I created this podcast. And unlike other podcasts, this one is host-driven, not guest-driven. That means I will be rotating health and wellness experts 3 times a week to give you the giant box of wellness crayons, not just the primary colors, so you can start building a meaningful life. It's time to give singlehood a cape. Today's host is someone I go way back with. His name is Sean Cardinale. Sounds like a baseball player. He's a coach, writer, and activist who returned to coaching on sex and love addiction at the outset of the pandemic after a 4-year hiatus. He speaks the language, and his coaching style tends to lean toward 12-step recovery, which saved his own life and livelihood 14 years ago. He's also very transparent. Sean earned his local certification through Linda Barks' holistic coaching methodology and is pursuing his ICF certification and a degree in social work. So beyond sex and love addiction, Sean's practice focuses on intimacy, relationships, divorce, dating, and the creative process. Enjoy Sean Cardinale.
All right. Hey, everybody. It's Sean Cardinale, sex and love addiction coach. And on this podcast, I have a very good friend of mine, Seth Rogers. Welcome, Seth.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Happy to be here.
I'm so glad to have you on. Seth and I go back. You know what, dude? I was thinking, I don't even know. Is it more than 5 years now?
No, it's actually 3.5.
Three and a half years. Seth and I find that we can sit and talk and solve the world's problems, all good, just the two of us, and yet keep the information to ourselves. We're jealous with the information. Mm-hmm. Y'all have to pay instead. But no, I love Seth Rogers. He's actually a recovery brother of mine. He's a high school teacher. What's your favorite shit to teach, man?
You know, I'm a math teacher. Not because I'm one of those people that's passionate about math and just thinks in numbers all the time, but just because I think it's kind of a fun subject to teach. It's like a puzzle, you know, and it's very concrete. So you know when students get it, you know when they don't. So you have a lot of those aha moments. Plus, I just don't know enough about, you know, grammar or social sciences to pull off history or English. But yeah, teaching math. And then also, you know, decided to try out physics for the year, and that's been a blast.
What was that last part? I think I lost you for saying you tried to what?
No, trying out physics as well. So I'm teaching a physics class in addition to math. God. And that's just been kind of trial and error, but I mean that's teaching for you.
Yeah. It's really interesting to me that you say that. Well, one, I totally appreciate how you're like, math is either like you got it, you did the equation correctly, or you didn't. That's very, for a brain like mine, that's very good. Of course, I'm like completely right-brained. And so the history and the writing, the humanities stuff was all my jam. But it's also interesting that you say you couldn't carry the social studies or history or literature or the grammar. That's total bullshit. My man Seth is being super modest. That is actually most of the shit that we talk about, society's ills and society's gains, right? Do a little, how can I characterize it? You know, we do a little transcendentalism. Will we be redeemed? Can we save ourselves? Are we anti-transcendentalists? No, we're just fucked and we're just trying to do our best. Well, we're trying to do our best while we're here either way. But I found over the last 3.5 years that I've had some really good conversations with Seth. So wanted to bring him on for the Single on Purpose podcast and have another one of these conversations. Also, because his personal history and background is really, I think, interesting, not the norm. for someone, you're what? Are you like early 30s? I can't remember. Feel like I'm way older, and yet you're wise as fuck. So
I don't know about that, but I'm 31.
Oh my God. I would be 50 this year. Yeah. See, so dude, I swear to God, I would have like, now that you're not youthful, and don't look young, but I swear to God, I'd be talking like a fucking 40-year-old or something. And now I'm going to be accused of being an ageist, but whatever. Anyway, Seth is a great guy. He's got a great personality. He's got a great head on his shoulders. And despite, you know, the humbleness about, social, studies or English or lit, you know, again, very smart dude and loquacious, and I appreciate you being here. So the part about your story that's really interesting, what we're going to talk about today is sort of dating and religious convictions. And this was a great topic that Seth chose because there's a lot that he can share on that. And before we get closer to the kernel of that, why don't you explain, tell everybody how Brazil is a big part of your upbringing.
Yeah, so I was born in Michigan, but then when I was 8, my parents, who were missionaries at a time working for a nonprofit Christian organization, decided they wanted to scratch this itch to live overseas. And so we originally, our plan was to go to Caracas, Venezuela. And we visited Caracas when I was 7. There was a family, another American family that we're going to partner with there. But, you know, shit started to hit the fan. And as we all know, it's only gone downhill, unfortunately, for the people of Caracas and Venezuela in general. But So that family decided to jump ship, if you will, after spending, I think, you know, 16 years there. But and the organization said, hey, how about you go to Brazil? And my parents, this was, mind you, 2 months before we were supposed to go to Venezuela. And my parents were like, hey, why not? Let's do it. So we stopped learning Spanish, started learning Portuguese, and
they're related. It's all good.
It overlaps.
You gotta make that zzz sound. Exactly. instead of the
Yeah, as one of my Colombian friends says, he says, yeah, Portuguese is just, you know, how you speak Spanish when you're still learning Spanish. So nice. I disagree though. I think it's a more sensual, and anyways, we can get into that another time. But so moved to Brazil and spent total of 8 years there. Thankfully, my parents had the wisdom to put me in a Brazilian school, and so I was, you know, completely socialized into Brazilian culture, and it just became not even a part of my identity because it wasn't conscious so much as really a part of my fabric. I didn't identify as Brazilian, but I became Brazilian, and that became very apparent when I came back to the States as a 16-year-old. And then, you know, of all places, we moved to Texas and yada, yada. But so Brazil is in my DNA. I love that country, and I'm trying to make my way back.
You eventually want to get back? You want to be have a little more of your adult life out there, like permanently, you think?
Oh, yeah.
Or you think you'll go and then come back again?
No, that is where my heart is. And my plan was actually to be there already, but I met my girlfriend, which is an excellent reason to deviate from my plan. And, you know,
she'll be glad to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm here and I'm happy to be in New Mexico. I do, you know, of all places in the US, New Mexico is one that I feel good about being in. It's not, I get tired of the kind of artificial, commercial, materialistic vibe that you can get from the States. But, you know, there's something a little more spiritual and, you know, dare I say, enchanting, despite the slogan. You know, I know it's corny, but it is kind of an enchanting and strange state. It really deviates from the norm of a lot of the, you know, greater US. So I'm cool being here for the time being.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's not corny, the enchantment thing. I mean, it's funny. I'm looking at my windows, we're recording, it's fucking snowing right now. Just FYI, I don't know if you can see out, but so in the last 48 hours, 72 hours, everybody, it rained, it snowed, it hailed. There might have been frogs. I was waiting for let's just go full Armageddon, like, you know, and locusts. But no, it is beautiful out here. The land is beautiful. And what I noticed when we came out here 16, 17 years ago was I had never been in a city. And, you know, when we say city, it's a big town. Mm-hmm. Albuquerque is not like cosmopolitan. It's not like when you go to Chicago or New York or even San Francisco, but in the metro area, there's still a million people. So it's not like tiny. But I'd never been in a city where you could stand in a spot and you have a 360 degree vista. And just like you have a good accent with your Venezuela and your Caracas and all that. I mean, my kids are bilingual in Spanish, not Portuguese. Their mother is New Mexican, like goes back hundreds of years here. And so, they're fluent. I say the words with the correct accent. And I notice that you do too when you talk about where you've been and where you're from, where you were raised rather. And to see that vista and just go out into the desert and find yourself or lose yourself either way, and then go back up to the mountains. I mean, the mountains are covered with snow right now, the Sandias. It's beautiful. It's beautiful here. So I think I'm glad that you found a place that resonates with you that way. I know you're very, very spiritual minded. We'll probably be talking about the distinction between spiritual and religious, mm-hmm. I'm sure, in this conversation. And we can get right to it, though. But no, you're totally right about the enchanted. There's a lot of spirit here. There's so much history. And so then there's so much spirituality and religion. We know the tougher parts of that history, but there's definitely a place for you to come out, like I said, and find yourself or lose yourself. And it's peaceful. And the pace, when I first moved out here from LA, I remember I had to like downshift my body and mind. The pace is completely different. It's its own thing. That's why the corny joke is actually Land of Manana. And I think locals don't really dig on that, but some of them also say it. So I don't know. It's like a mixed bag, but it really is like, hey, just, your pace, your space, your pace, your time, do what you like. We don't really enforce stop signs, red lights, or like imposing ourselves on others. But it's very rich with all the culture here anyway. It very much looks like, right, the Pueblo style everywhere. Right. Mm-hmm. That's not, I go back to California. I'm like, oh, look, there's an actual blue house or a green house or something. Right. Out here is a lot of tans and browns and then blue. And blue is that, that kind of
turquoise.
Traditions. Yeah. Turquoise. Right. 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 So as far as religion and spirituality, if we're talking about dating and religious convictions, why did you pick the topic? And then let's talk about your journey. Like you said, your parents are missionaries. And I don't know if you can get specific or want to get specific about what thread or strand of evangelism they are. But anyway, let's get into that. Let's get into the background. And then let's talk about how that affected your dating and how it affected you being single, which is like, again, this whole podcast. So.
Right. So when we were in Michigan, we went to an evangelical free church, I think it is what it was called. Basically non-denominational. I don't know if there's some finer points to that distinction, but for all intents and purposes, yeah, just evangelical free, non-denominational. My parents, to their credit, I think have always been very open-minded and have in many ways kind of helped move the needle forward in making the evangelical circles that they've been a part of slightly more progressive. And, of course, within a certain box, a certain Christian paradigm, but nevertheless, they've never strayed away from speaking truth to power and raising the bullshit flag. They've never been much for politics. And so I never had this attachment to a church institution, to a religious institution. It was always more an allegiance to the ideas, which I think is very kind of Protestant at its core. So maybe that's not so unorthodox for the Protestant side of Christianity, but regardless, they did encourage me to think for myself. And I think if it weren't for that, I wouldn't be where I am today. I wouldn't be recording this podcast because I would just be thinking the same way I did when I was in Michigan. But I was given the permission, not full permission, but I was still encouraged to think for myself and be critical about the very things that I was learning from my parents and from other adults in my life.
It's interesting. I pulled up Howard Zinn, monster progressive activist and academic. And one of his books and one of his sayings was, you can't be neutral on a moving train. And that's the line that popped up in my head when you said that they didn't really dive into or didn't really, you know, affect or maybe really encourage conversations on politics. And I won't say encourage, I don't want to mischaracterize, but yeah, that's interesting because you have said clearly they encourage you to get progressive and think for yourself and push the needle a little bit. But yeah, even being non-political or apolitical is a political choice, right? And there's also some privilege that comes with the ability to be like, I can just step back. And in fact, it's kind of part of the conversation that I was telling you that I had on another podcast that'll be airing soon when we got into some politics. I was like, oh shit, it went some different places that I thought. But I appreciate that they encourage you to stretch a bit, right? And challenge a bit and seek out knowledge, new means, whatever. How, when you're 16 and you guys get why did you leave? And then once you got back to the States, what happened as far as your beliefs? Now you're a young man in your teens, you're in high school in the States after being a huge chunk. I mean, you grew up in Brazil, like you said. Oh, and what city, by the way? Sao Paulo or where?
Yeah, we're in the state of Sao Paulo in a city called Campinas, which is about an hour and a half outside of the city of Sao Paulo. And it's a medium large city, about 2 million, but doesn't necessarily give off the vibes of, you know, Sao Paulo's urban sprawl. So that's where we were. And then in Rio, and that was in college. And that's the city, honestly, that I feel the most spiritual connection to. But it's not where I grew up.
Rio. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which one of those cities has the huge statue?
Well, that's you. Yeah. The Christ the Redeemer, Cristo Redentor. Yeah.
Is in Rio.
That's in Rio. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I got to get down there someday, especially if you go down there, they'll be like, oh, good. Like I have a double reason to go visit my homies and see the amazing land and people and culture.
No, absolutely.
And so you get back, you're 16. Let's just, to get to our topic here, I mean, you're 16. I mean, at 16, we tend to be young, dumb, and full of cum. So when you get back, what are the sort of precepts, or if any, and disabuse me if these are the wrong words, like what sort of, I don't know, limitations or rules, or what sort of doors opened for you through your parents and through coming back to, now you've got to like reacculturate to the States when really, I mean, eight, you're pretty malleable. You grew up again in Brazil. Mm-hmm. So you come back, and then how does that start to affect your acculturation and then your dating? And again, it's going to be a cultural difference and also a religious cultural difference. So how does that all start to form?
Yeah, I love how you said that. I kind of grew up a second time in Brazil, and that's completely spot on. I mean, in my years in Michigan, my sister and I were just talking about this. We were not socialized very well. My parents, they homeschooled us. Right, wrong, or indifferent. And that was great academically, but I really felt stunted socially. And that
when you
became
came
very,
back, or this was down here.
This was in Michigan. This was in Michigan before we went to Brazil.
Before you left.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So where I was born, and then, you know, until I was eight, really the only person I hung out with on a consistent basis was my sister, you know, okay. And so, and she and I were a little bit feral. So we were both, I think, above average academically because we got so much one-on-one attention from our parents who both have college degrees and are critically minded and are both teachers at some point, but we didn't know how to be just normal kids with other kids. And we were more comfortable with adults because that's most of the people that we spent time with. And so so it was like growing up a second time when I went to Brazil. And not only was I not being homeschooled, but I was thrust into a school in a language and a culture that I knew nothing about whatsoever. I knew one word when we moved to Brazil, one word in Portuguese. And then we had a,
what was it?
I don't even remember. I think it was yes, sing, you know, like, I think it was something like that, mm-hmm. but didn't get me very far. But within a few months, I was fluent in Portuguese. It just, and, you know, no thinking shit. Back, I was talking to my best friend from Brazil, and, you know, the first day of school, he was like, hey, come, you know, kind of like gesturing, like, come sit next to me. He didn't speak English. I didn't speak Portuguese, but that's how the friendship started. And I don't remember what it was like to not understand him. It just, you know, that was kind of seamless. But, and so even though I resisted absorbing Brazilian culture because I was very patriotic and, you know, as in many Latin American countries, they're all too familiar with the dark side of the American government, mm-hmm. and specifically the influence that the American government has had on their more authoritarian regimes, all the dictatorships that the CIA, you know, deliberately encouraged mm-hmm. to fight back communism and, you know, you know, prevent the domino effect and all that bullshit. And so they were very cynical about the US government, loved American pop culture, but not so much the political side of things. And so I pushed back and I was very patriotic. And yet Brazilian culture was still inevitably baked into who I was. And so then coming back to the States when I was 16, I remember vividly we're in the airport and a part of me was excited to go back to the States because that's where we would go for, you know, vacation, quote unquote. Really, it was more fundraising trips for my parents because all of their income came from churches and people they knew that would make contributions. And so it's just how their organization rolls. But to me, it was where we would go on summers and it was where I would go to visit family and, you know, maybe go to Disney World. You know, it was just this kind of idyllic place and an escape from, the cultural incongruence that I felt in Brazil. And yet when I step off the plane and we're met by this customs agent, he says, "Welcome home." And that's when I realized, oh shit, I don't feel at home here. This is not my home. This mm-hmm. is my little escape from my home, but my home is in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And so it was this very strange reverse culture shock. And I felt very out of place. And yet it was worse than being in Brazil in some ways because there was no reason for me to be out of place. I didn't have an accent. I you know, nobody really knew or cared so much that I had lived in Brazil. And so it was like, look, you're a white kid in the suburb of Dallas, like, you know, this, like, you're middle class, like, you've got nothing to bitch about, going to a good public school. So what's the big deal? And it was difficult for me. So, you know, at that point though, as far as dating is concerned, that was so much at the forefront of my mind. It was taking, don't get me wrong, it was taking up a lot of real estate in the background of my mind, but in the forefront of my mind, I was kind of in survival mode. I've always had kind of blessing and curse of being an overachiever. I think it's more of a curse because it really stems from this need for approval and this feeling of lack and of not measuring up. And so I derive great satisfaction from getting people's attention by doing something that I feel like I have earned, or, you know, accomplishing something that I feel like I've earned. And anyways, also some middle child syndrome there, but all that to say, I kind of just like ground myself in school and then athletics. I joined the cross country and the track team. Wanted to join the football team. The coach was like, "Yeah, this is a 5A school in Texas. You've never played football, so you can join, but you're going to be a punching bag."
Right, you're going to get flattened. Yeah. Right. You weren't raised in the Friday Night Lights zone.
Multi-million-dollar football stadium at my school that was good enough for the Dallas Cowboys to train on when their training facility was under construction. So no, I did not pursue that. My dad was like, "How about cross country?" I was like, "That sounds great." I just kind of buried myself in that and did not, you know, aside from interacting with my peers in cross country and track, which, you know, was a motley crew, I did not put myself out there very much. And that kind of continued into my college days. And so I kind of just stuck with my MO, which was to have, you know, these intense crushes and infatuations for women, but I would keep them at a distance, out of insecurity, out of this feeling that this sense of inadequacy, and then also this sense of obligation, because at the time I was
to your religion.
Yes.
Because I was gonna ask you, like, weren't you proscribed at all, or were you? Let me ask, mm-hmm. not say it in the negative, but were you proscribed? Like, was there what was the rule for your evangelical parents? What was the rule as far as sex, dating? You gave me a note earlier about when you were 13, you told your parents you were ready to date, and they expressed some hesitance, and then, you know, what? So back up to 13 in this book and everything they handled yeah. you, so and then come back up to 16. Because we are talking about dating and, you know, religious convictions, and, you know, is that oil and water, or can it just flow nicely? Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah. So
go to the 13 one, and then catch us back up to being back in the States at 16.
Yeah, 13 is definitely a good place to start, because that's when, you know, so I'm still in Brazil at that time, and I there was a girl that I was interested in. Honestly, she was a good person. She was attractive. I'm 13. I'm seeing lots of people dating around me. Brazil is much more liberal sexually than the U.S. And mm-hmm. so
I've seen the photo beaches, man. I'm like,
oh yeah. Oh yeah. Goodness. So I thought, you know what? I would like to try my hand at this dating thing. And I told my parents that, because I always, you know, kind of felt the need to keep them in the loop, and I wanted their approval. And so I told them, I was like, you know what, guys, I didn't say guys, but I was like, you know what, I you know, homies,
you've got a cup of coffee with your mom and dad in the morning.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Newspaper. No, but I said, you know what, I broached the topic, and I was like, you know what, I think I'm ready to date. That's what I said. I think I'm ready to date. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, and they felt like I was too young. And instead of encouraging me to date, they encouraged me to read two books. One was by Rebecca St. James called Wait For Me. Not Date For Me, but Wait For Me. Mm-hmm. which again became a part of my dating strategy, just waiting. Mm-hmm. And then another one, which was even more impacting, was I Kissed Dating Goodbye by Joshua Harris. Mm-hmm. And just want to put out there that the author, to his credit, although in his book, which he wrote when he was 22, yikes. In his book, his position is basically like, hey, I dated around so much and it doesn't lead anywhere. And so instead of essentially like preemptively cheating on my spouse through all of these frivolous relationships, just, you know, don't date to get to know somebody, get to know somebody through friendships and group setting. And then when you find the right person, get married. But he has since, he talks about it on his website. I think it's called Joshua Harris something. He regrets writing that book. And he actually even, to his credit, came out with a documentary where he interviews all the people that felt like they were kind of damaged by the message in that book.
That's a big mea culpa. Like he really, that's in recovery circles, we call that a monster. That's a monster amends, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a big amends.
Absolutely.
And what's interesting to me is the first part that you said, he was 22.
22.
It's like, if I wrote something when I was 22, I mean, come on.
Exactly.
The further away you are from it, the more you realize that's kind of absurd. Like, you can be a poet or an artist. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Let me not, again, people, oh God, I'm going to sound like ageist. Like every time, like I'm this grumpy old man, like wagging my finger, like you kids. But yeah, I mean, if you're talking about something as instrumental,
exactly.
Most of us in our earliest 20s are, I mean, that's when you can, you know, if you played it cool until then in America, I don't know what it is in Brazil, but you know, you can go out, you're driving, you're about to get out of college. If you go to college, or you've been working a couple of years if you haven't, and you're now drink if you can't. So those are your exploding years socially, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's just like coming off you in waves, right? I mean, and you're not in school anymore, or you're just getting out. So there's this sense of freedom. This is like when you start. And so this guy is saying, no, let's draw that back in. Let's not sort of, Alan. Alan's a friend, a mutual friend of ours. He and I did a podcast on dating, you know, dating like single on purpose. We were doing this dating on purpose, or dating as practice. And so it's the exact opposite of this guy Harris's philosophy, which is like, no, go out and be you, learn to be you, learn about yourself in a social and a potentially romantic situation across from someone, right? Where you're building something potentially. And then if not, okay, it's practice. You just go and do that again whenever you want to, right?
Yeah, I'm
like a podcast, you stay single or whatever, but go ahead.
I'm shaking my head because I'm just like, ah, why did you and Alan not descend from the heavens and tell me that?
15, 17 years ago or whatever.
Why?
your parents?
Yeah, go ahead.
It'll be like an intervention.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
We're going to help your future self. It's like a force ghost. We would have been
exactly.
Force ghosts. But no. So your parents put these books in front of you, how do you remember your reaction to them? You're 13, but again, you're very astute. You guys are this like really academically minded and education minded family, plus evangelical. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you read them, right? Did you read them front to back?
Oh yeah, no? I read them. And I accepted them hook, line, and sinker. I was very conscientious and also very compliant. I wanted the approval of the adults in my life. And they were all Christian and they all had similar ideas. I mean, one of our family friends, incidentally, the mother of the girl that I was interested in, she told my mom one time after meeting our teacher, one of our Portuguese teachers, as in like an English teacher in the US, but in Brazil, who was a young woman in her 30s, attractive, wore flattering clothes, not inappropriate at all. Maybe there's like a little bit of cleavage, which was absolutely acceptable culturally. And yet this, the mother of my crush told my mom, I would be concerned for my son's thought life. But the teacher,
Telling right there. Dude, I've never heard those two words come together like that. Yeah. That is fucking amazing.
So those were the people that I was looking up to, that I wanted to please, and the books told me how to. And for somebody that was very prone and is still recovering from black and white thinking, it made total sense. You know, why dabble in the gray and the messy, icky gray of dating when you can just go from being friends with really very little on the line, very little risk of rejection without having to put yourself out there, and then just fast forward to marriage. You know, I think at a subconscious level, it kind of seemed like a really good deal because it allowed me to just forego, you know, the vulnerability of really trying out dating, which is a challenging journey. But I really wish I had had somebody in my corner that encouraged me to do that, because I just kind of hunkered down I was a little antisocial. I wasn't a complete loner, but I just did not put myself out there enough. And then, you know, paralleling this was also my struggle with pornography. And so I was introduced to pornography when I was 10, to internet pornography. A friend of mine a classmate was over to do a group project. And I knew nothing about the internet. Even though the internet was really scaling up and something that, you know, we had Google and whatnot at the time. This was 2002. I didn't know how to use it. And so instead of Googling songs that I liked, you know, my favorite Eminem songs or whatever, or Red Hot Chili Peppers, I would wait every week for Friday night when it would be on a top 10 countdown of Brazil's MTV. But this kid, he kind of changed everything for me. And it was like, you know, show me this music website, which on the side had ads for, you know, kind of softcore porn. And of course, I took a mental note, came back to it and kept coming back to it. And this really just wrecked me because I felt this total dissonance. I felt like a complete fraud whenever I'd look at porn, because I'm trying to be this goody two shoes, this Christian boy, this saint. And then I felt like I was doing this abominable thing. And so really just kind of, you know, taking both sides of my quote unquote double life to the extreme in my mind, when in reality they were a lot closer than I thought to each other. And what I was doing was not healthy, but it also wasn't as bad as I thought. And you know, who I was as a Christian was also not healthy, and was not as good as I thought. But all that
to... So you've got the typical guilt and shame and all that brewing. You don't have an outlet because of these. You've essentially been restricted. I mean, self-restricting, but also your parents, you know, kind of literally put in front of you, like, this is how we shepherding you, but not toward it, but really away from dating and that, those crucial sort of developmental steps. I remember when my son, he's going to kill me if he ever plays this back. He's 16 now, and he's like 6'2". He's just grown like a weed. But I remember when he was 12 or 13, shorter than me. I'm only 5'8". He was little. And God, he might have even been 12, because I think it was right at the cusp of junior high or just before. And we all went to, so he has, right, me and his mom and stepdad, right, my ex-wife and the stepdad. And everyone was at a table at one end of Olive Garden. And then my son and his little girlfriend, who he wanted to take out on a dinner date, were at the other end by themselves and ordering and everything. And how different, how contrasting a scenario is that from what you experienced. And look, maybe even that isn't for everybody, but there was nothing, 0% negatives, you know, something percent salaciousness or anything. It was a boy who wanted to do something on his own socially with a girl. And we encouraged that. And we're like, you guys are young. You're not going to go like just be somewhere around adults by yourselves. And of course, you know, of course we'll pay the bill and blah, 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 blah. But still, it was just really cute and sort of fostered that, you know, if you want to do this, just, you know, ask and we'll drive you or do that and everything. And, you know, again, now he can drive himself wherever and go, and he goes and meets his friends wherever he does. But I just thought of that contrast, you know, compared to here are two books that, you know, the word that kept popping up when you were talking, Seth, was repress. And I don't mean that to shit on your parents. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, we can talk about, at one point you had mentioned, like, you know, we probably won't have time now. We'll just do a part two on this or just have another interview with you, but another session. But, you know, you were mentioning dating practices and other cultures and religion and all this. And we know that in some countries and some places, you know, there's, or still even here, probably for evangelical families, there's arranged marriages, or it's all very sort of circumscribed. And you have the pros and the cons from the folks themselves. Like, especially, I'm no expert, so I want to make that clear, but especially if we're talking outside of the United States, you will hear like, well, you know, I mean, it wasn't like love or whatever, but they put us together and we made a go of it. And then you also hear like, oh my God, I want my own, you know, sense of plotting the course of my own life, not just educationally, not just socially, but sexually and intimately. And so these books sort of like put a break on that potential for that growing process. And then unfortunately, like you're saying, you bump right into, just like me and so many others did, bump right into, and we're like almost 20 years difference in age, but the power of porn, especially internet, it's just the access is just, you know, so you have these two contrasting but concurrent situations. I mean, go back up to 16 then, or even, I think you were even going up to college, and didn't you at one point have a dating scenario or two and a sexual scenario, one or two or whatever? And again, what's going on in your mind in those scenarios vis-a-vis this religious upbringing, right? Religious convictions, sort of hardcore, you know, convictions.
Yeah, you know, I really did not give myself permission to dabble in the dating world until I had cut ties with the religion that I was brought up in. And I, by the way, I just want to say, I love what, you know, the story you told of your son having a date at the other end of the table. And I love that. That is beautiful. And that's the way it should be. That is so healthy. And it's such a fantastic way of encouraging your kids to, A, be transparent about their dating life with you, to seek your counsel, and then also to encourage it as something familial, as, you know, and to just kind of raise your kids through that. I feel like my growth in dating was absolutely stunted. It was, you know, kind of uprooted as a small little plant in some ways. Not to sound too dramatic, but honestly, in hindsight, you know, and
it's hugely impactful.
Very,
hugely
impactful. Very much so. And so porn was like this, I think, kind of relief valve, not a good one, mind you, but that's what was going on. It was, you know, the only way for me to override those very black and white convictions that were hampering me, mm-hmm. was to just, you know, pull the breaker and just shut it off completely and throw mm-hmm. caution out the window. And that's how my first sexual encounter went. And so in college,
before you go there,
yeah,
I'm sorry, hang on. Before you go there, I want, in case no one has ever heard either of us speak, I called Seth my recovery brother when we first started this podcast, and that is in and around sex and love addiction. And I want to make it clear that I will not speak for you, Seth, but I am not, I always put this out here so people know where I'm coming from. I am not just anti-porn, like fundamentalist style. I can't do it because it's unhealthy for me. It's destroyed my relationships, my job opportunities, my career, and even parenting trajectory. And so I had to surrender that, get the therapy, get the 12 step. That's how I met you. And then proceed, right, to do intimacy and sexuality healthily. And for me, that doesn't include porn. So when we're talking about, when folks listening are hearing like Seth's experience with porn or mine or these early sexual experiences, not only is it the religious and those factors in your life, but it's also that the porn became more than, you know, it became more than just an experience as youth. It became overwhelming. And, you know, like we call it, cunning, baffling, and powerful, to where it's affecting the day-to-day management and healthfulness of your life. Is that fair?
Yeah. And in my case, it wasn't, I think it wasn't so much because of the volume of porn that I was consuming, because it was probably pretty moderate compared to my peers. And yet the effect was just so palpable. The degree of the experience was so extreme for me. It was like going from 0 to 60. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't even kiss a girl until I was 21.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Because in college, just kind of staying on the same trajectory as high school, I'm going to a military academy, so it's even more stifling, even more demanding, and I just kind of buried myself in that grind. And now if I thought that being an overachiever was encouraged in high school, it was super encouraged, because even my social performance to a degree had a number attached to it, had a GPA attached to it. Physical performance had a GPA attached to it. And then of course my academic performance. And so I had every excuse in the world to just insulate myself in this little bubble of performance and to not really take any chances socially out in the dating world. And but then my saving grace came kind of in two parts. The first was my best friend, who's still my best friend, we met in a Bible study. And then he, being less risk averse than me, and kind of chases
that's
after
a great way
risk.
Of putting it. Yeah, that's a great.
Yeah,
way. You know, is this an American friend or a Brazilian friend?
American friend. He was also going to the same college as me. You know, college entre comillas because of military academy. So it wasn't really the college life, but he became, long story short, an atheist. And so then, and through the process of me trying to convince him that he was wrong, I convinced myself that I had a lot of borrowed convictions. And so I was like, shoot, maybe.
Did you say barbed?
Borrowed.
Borrowed.
Yeah, borrowed convictions, things that I had kind of just accepted because of external motivators, as opposed to really internal realizations. And so that kind of freed me up to question what I was believing. And then before I knew it, I was like, you know what? I don't associate with Christianity. And a lot of it has never really made sense to me. And so I'm not like anti-Christianity, but I am agnostic. And at this point in my life, I would say I'm not agnostic because I do have a deeper sense of faith than I did at the time. But
right now you're talking.
Yeah,
about.
Right now. But I do not consider myself a Christian, although I still hold many Christian. Or let me rephrase that. I hold many of Jesus's teachings near and dear in my heart. So little side note there. But I'd become an agnostic in college, and then so that was part one of my kind of transformation. Part two was I signed up for a study abroad semester back to Brazil. So it was kind of like study home, not abroad.
Right.
But I tricked my school into sending me there. You know, didn't trick them. I mean, they knew that I spoke Portuguese, but I did a really good job of marketing myself. I said, I hope the other guys that go.
I will be a fantastic representative.
Exactly. I'm going to be an ambassador. I'm going to be, anyway. So, and they loved it. And so they sent me, and it was just like mind blown because so many things happened at once. You know, I'm for all intents and purposes, a civilian in this big city with, a good amount of disposable income. I say a good amount. It wasn't that much, but to me, it seemed like a ton. Just my per diem, that my allowance that I was given by the military. And I have free reign on this city. My classes, my schedule was easy in comparison because I didn't have all this military bullshit to contend with and juggle. And there's all these, beautiful women. I mean, at this military academy, there's only 20% girls, and most of them are already called for. And so, I don't want to say called for. That makes it sound like people are calling dibs on them. They were already in relationships for the most part. And so, so it was just like total contrast, and so many opportunities for me to kind of put myself out there and meet interesting women from all sorts of countries because there were tons of other exchange students hailing from all around the world. And so but again, kind of going back to the escape valve approach to this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde approach to sexuality, I still hadn't really turned the corner on that and found a healthy balance. And so instead of just starting off in a relationship, my first kiss was going to a club in Brazil and then making out with a stranger who I never saw again. That was the only way that I could again bypass my very rigid ideologies that I was still trying to shake, that I still had this firm allegiance to at a very subconscious level, even though I didn't consciously subscribe to the ideals anymore. And so
did you need alcohol as a lubricant that
yes,
night?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there was alcohol involved. And then I wanted to impress the two guys that I was with. And so, and yet I am like shaking because
right,
I'm so
right.
nervous because I've never even kissed a girl.
You're again, like we talked about the trajectory, you're doing at like what, 21, 22?
Mm-hmm. 21, yeah.
Or yeah, what we usually tend to get a head start at like 13, 14,
yep.
15, even if it's 16, that's fine. Like that may be quote unquote later, especially for Gen Z, like my kids, my teens age, but still that's like, all right. It's still part, it's in the soup.
Mm-hmm.
Of what's going on right then, right? And you didn't have any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yours was repressed. And then like you're saying, you have this, I was going to call porn your cock blocker. It's like, cause it wasn't good. And that's crude. It also misses the point that we're talking about healthy sexual growth, and that was impeding you as well as the religious convictions. Right. So you have this one little, you have your stash, like we call it, you have your secret little thing over here with the porn that's saying, come to me instead. And then you have these religious convictions. And so you kiss the girl in the club and that happens. And when is your next or first or whatever dating or sexual experience, you know, from then?
Yeah. So I kind of want to go back to what you said about porn as being a cock blocker. I think that's a great way to put it. And I think that's why you and I abstain from porn, not because we're saying that it is unequivocally, categorically, inherently bad, but because, you know, for people like you and me, it was allowing us to live in our minds instead of living in our lives. And, you know, and so it was cock blocking us, not just romantically, but just from the beauty of life. And so,
everything.
Yeah, so that I just wanted to echo that. But, you know, after I lost my kissing virginity in that dingy little club in Rio, I was like, oh shit, like, it just gave me this confidence. It started to nurture some confidence that, you know what? Girls, I can approach a girl cold turkey. You know, yeah, I was a little awkward, but it was still a good experience. I still enjoyed it. I think she enjoyed it. And I'm okay. I'm not on fire yet. I haven't burned up. You know, I've been struck by lightning.
Right.
You know, like, I can do this. I can fucking do this. And so there was this girl that caught my attention, and she was just a really free-spirited exchange student from Mexico. And I befriended her, and then, you know, in my own kind of bumpy way, started dating her. And then, you know, we had our first kiss. It was much more romantic. It was on the beach. I was still nervous, but it was good. And that was kind of my first, that was the relationship I wish I had when I was 13. Mm-hmm. But I'm, you know, something that you and I talk about in recovery is to not regret the past or shut the door on it. And so It's okay that I didn't have it when I was 13, because I did have it eventually. And I started, in a sense, kind of making up for lost time, if you will. And so we had that. It, you know, I call it a relationship. It was never official, and it was only a few months, only while the semester lasted. And then we parted ways and went to our respective countries. But I stayed in touch with her, and she remained a friend. And it was a really beautiful connection that we had, and a very genuine one. And so that was kind of what launched me into the dating world. But we were not sexually active. And she was not religious, but she was more conservative. And as any listeners that are familiar with Mexican culture know, it is much more conservative sexually and religiously than many other countries in Latin America, much more so than Brazil.
Super Catholic.
Very Catholic, yep.
Very Catholic, and you can have, I mean, I imagine like Brazil, and I won't misspeak. I've been to Mexico a couple of times because I have family down there. And I mean, again, socially will be different, and in some ways a little more loose than America, but then in other ways, like, you better get your ass, you can go party on Friday, but get your ass into church on Sunday.
Yes.
Right. And
yes.
And like very steeped in that. So go ahead. So you have this relationship and this experience with her that wasn't like sex per se, but sexual and intimate.
Yeah.
And you stayed in touch. And then what happens next? Because what I want to do is, of course, because you and I, again, this is what we do in our lives, sit and talk and listen and share with each other. I want to end, if you're all right with it, I want to end in the next few minutes with, if you're comfortable with it, that first sexual experience. And then we'll just do a part two, because, brother, I have like a page of notes, these amazing notes that you gave that I think would help impart, you know, some wisdom, some experience, some strength, some hope to folks who, again, have a similar sort of, you know, what came up in my head as you're sharing is the word retarded, not in the pejorative, but literally your growth was retarded as a result of this you know, evangelical. And again, your folks don't sound, you know, socially a little more progressive, even religiously a little more progressive. It's not fire and brimstone, even though you just joked about, like, I didn't catch on fire. I didn't like fall into a vortex of hell, you know, because I kissed a girl and hung out with her for a summer or a season. And so I just think it's healing to hear the kind of thing you're sharing, because people who have been in a similar experience, you know, I have a friend who was raised in a fucking evangelical cult, for God's sakes. I mean, people who hear these sort of repressive stories then can have some hope that they can be single on purpose, dating on purpose. They can have a sexual, healthy, progressive lifestyle or livelihood on purpose, and not, you know, the keel can be evened, right? The ship can be righted. Mm-hmm. It's not a condemnation just because the earliest part of the development was, again, retarded, was cut off from where it might have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think what made it difficult for me to unentangle myself from those more conservative ideals that weren't serving me later in life, maybe served me in some ways, but that I didn't want to be encumbered by anymore. But what made it so difficult to unravel that was the fact that my parents were not overtly oppressive, at least not to me. My sister has a different perspective, but as the compliant middle child, people pleaser, I didn't realize that was something that had been inculcated in me to the degree that it was, because my parents, they were not by any means the fire and brimstone kind of people. And they, they would host parties at our house. And if they were making a little Brazilian cocktail, they'd give me one when I was a teenager, you know? And so,
nice.
You know, seemingly very progressive in some ways, but not so much in the dating world. But then, you know, kind of fast forwarding back to college, I come back from that semester abroad in Brazil. It was this amazing, amazing experience. And then also amazing for some spiritual reasons as well. And that's where I kind of started building up my own faith, you know, from ground zero. It was really beautiful.
And you came back agnostic, like you were saying. You came back
agnostic,
open to, but some skepticism, some questioning.
Agnostic, but now I started the semester pretty agnostic, pretty like, hey, I don't know. And then I ended the semester, I guess you could say, agnostic with a twinkle in my eye. You know,
a hopeful agnostic.
Yes, exactly.
There's something there. I'm going to keep, you know, reading up on it, yep, and meditating on it.
Yep, exactly. I felt this connection to life at large. And, but then again, I still had some pretty deeply rooted beliefs about sex specifically. I still very much so did not want to have sex until I got married. That still made sense to me. It made sense, right? That way I don't risk getting an STD. I don't risk getting a girl pregnant. And I just don't risk exactly
like we talk about, even healthy risk. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't risk becoming too attached to somebody that I might not end up with in the long term. And it was a very comfortable way of living and dating or not dating. And yet again, it's so funny. So I go on spring break again with my best friend, the crazy redhead, and we go to Cancun. It was me, him, another friend, and then my best friend's girlfriend. And, you know, we're at this, you know, one of those typical all-inclusive resorts that cater to spring breakers. We're sitting at the table having a cocktail from the open bar. And my best friend Joe, his girlfriend, was, you know, asking me about what I thought about sex and whatnot at this point, since I was, you know, no longer Christian. And I told her, I was like, you know, I think I still want to wait until I get married to have sex. And then that night I get plastered, have, you know, a few tequila shots too many, and end up in bed with a girl that I had just met, who was kind of a party animal herself. And
another American?
Another American. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so that you know, these kind of 0 to 60 experiences, they weren't helping my cause, because then in my mind, it was like, well, that's what, you know, having sex outside of marriage is. And I don't want that, because I was just drunk out of my mind, you know, it felt like
were you
I was
safe.
I would I no mm-hmm. no protection. Mm-hmm. You know, and she and I knew that she had, and she even told me she had sex with a different guy the night before, and probably a different guy the night before that. And you know, as far as the intercourse itself was concerned, it was felt like I was just masturbating with her body. There was mm-hmm. there was no connection, wow. and very very little pleasure as well because of the numbing effects of alcohol. And I was just like struggling to stay awake. So really. Mm-hmm.
I was going to joke to stay up, but yeah.
That
no,
too,
I,
you know, it was definitely
you,
a one and done.
Really, yeah, you've painted a really clear picture
yeah. Yeah,
of the experience. Go ahead.
Which just kind of reinforced that false dichotomy of either you're waiting until you're getting married or you're just throwing caution to the wind and jumping into the hookup scene, right, which is right. the extreme that I kissed dating goodbye kind of painted as the alternative mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. to waiting until marriage. There was no healthy middle ground. And again, in recovery, we talk all about living in the gray and the messiness of life. And that's kind of where the action happens. But so that, yeah. So again, that strange, fairly unhealthy experience, potentially risky. I mean, I come back from spring break and I'm getting an STD check and I'm just like, oh my God, right. What if I got
waiting for results?
Yeah. Waiting for results. And,
right.
You know, so yeah, not great, but yeah.
What would you, I think, like I said, I think that's a great place to pause mm-hmm. here and come back because again, dude, you're so astute. Your turns of phrase. I'm a writer, and I'm like writing down. I'm scribbling notes. Like, oh my God, use that in the podcast description, and also use that in like a book. So you're so eloquent and incisive. I want to come back with you, and we'll go through the additional bullets and every, you know, the broader topic, and maybe even catch up today. So get permission from your current girlfriend and see how much, you know, let's not offend or anything like that. But see if anything you can speak on there, you know, anonymously, not saying any names, but I'd like to then connect from that experience to mm-hmm. your more present day, how you healed from this religious conviction sort of firewall, you know, that you've now jumped over, as far as your sensuality, sexuality, both your religious convictions and your sexual convictions or aspirations change. And I sort of wanted to end with you with, you know, what do you think, especially now through recovery, which is an intimacy, behavioral, spiritual journey that you've been on and that we've shared and fostered and supported one another in this process. Cause I call it a way of life, right? I call it my livelihood, not just like, oh, I do something. I go to meetings. I say this all the time, right? This has now become part and parcel of how I live my days. Right. I mean, like a Buddhist would say they do, or like, you know, some other spiritualist would say, you know, or vegetarian, right? Like they do that as a part of their life. And I know that you have taken up these healthy convictions as well. And so with that current outlook in mind, as a 30-something year old man, early, fucking God, you're so young. I had no idea. See, that's how fucking wise you are. What would you like to tell your 13-year-old self? How can you sort of hold that younger you and you know, some kind of encouragement, or what message would you like to, and we'll end on this. What message would you like to share?
I would tell 13-year-old Seth, I would say, you know what, man? You have so much to offer. Get out there. Get messy, make mistakes, just like Miss Frizzle taught you in Magic School Bus. The world is big, and to quote a priest, Richard Rohr, you can't think your way to the right life. You have to live your way to more right thoughts. So have some fun. It's okay to make mistakes. And no matter what, you are going to be okay because you are worthy of love.
Mm.
That's it.
That's amazing. That's a way, and of course, I scribbled even more notes. You mentioned Richard Rohr. You're talking about you're going to be okay. Go ahead and make mistakes. Beautiful ending. We'll get back to even more of this next time we talk. And Seth Rogers, a good friend of mine. I love you, brother. And I really appreciate your time talking with us and sharing on dating and religious convictions, you know, and how in your experience through that, all these dichotomies and all these, you know, hot and cold and black and white experiences. And I'm glad to know you and learn from your healthfulness now and your spirituality. So thanks. And let's do this again, brother.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Sean. Had a blast. And I hope some people can glean a thing or two from my experiences, maybe help them unravel some of their own knots.
I think it will for sure. So have a good day, everybody. And we'll be back some other time soon. Take care.
I hope that episode was helpful. Hey, listen, if you want to share your singlehood journey, if you've gone somewhere and come back, if you have revelations and wisdom, please share your story. It's going to help other people. Nothing makes us feel more connected than hearing other people's stories. So just send me the audio of your story, and you could just record it directly from your phone and email it to theangrytherapist@gmail.com. Also, if you want our Single on Purpose newsletter, go to singleonpurpose.life. That's singleonpurpose.life. You will get tools and articles and other people's stories, and also Zoom links to private gathers. So if you want to join our community, go to singleonpurpose.life. Thank you for listening. Be well. We hope you tell a friend. Hey, before you go, I want to invite you to the Single on Purpose private community online. It's off of social media. No ads, no algorithms. We got forums, we got live groups, we got webinars, and we have social hangs. We also have offline in-person hangs happening soon. So check us out. Go to singleonpurpose.life. That's singleonpurpose.life, and I will see you inside.